Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Jonathan Sternberg, and I represent the relator, Jerry Cullen. On Mr. Cullen's petition, this Court issued a preliminary writ that prohibited the trial court from enforcing its, shall I say, sweeping order 3 years after the judgment in this case that summarily granted his ex-wife, Ms. Scroggins, motion to compel him to release to her, quote, without limitation, the contents of his Air Force personal, medical, and other files from the 24-year period of their marriage from 1985 to 2009, and to waive his right to privacy in them, even if it, quote, would result in a clearly unwarranted invasion of his personal privacy. This order exceeded the trial court's authority, and this court should make its preliminary writ permanent. Ms. Scroggins' unverified, vague, and hearsay-laden motion request for discovery to relitigate a finding in a three-year-old judgment of the number of reservist retirement points my client accrued during his marriage, because she says she now believes that number was incorrect, that finding was, quote, not correct, is barred by the doctrines of issue and claim preclusion and by the one-year limitation period in Rule 7406 on motions for relief from judgment for reason of mistake. And even if her motion isn't barred by any of these numerous reasons, the trial court certainly had no authority to grant it summarily without a hearing. Your Honors, I think this case comes down to a lesson on finality. And this court has been here before. In 1987, in a case called Sprung versus Negwer Materials, which is a case the parties didn't cite, this court held that, quote, a primary goal of the judicial system is finality. Litigation must end if the public is to have confidence in the court's ability to resolve disputes. Now, that case was a challenge to a default judgment. And despite noting that fairly vociferous language that I just quoted, the court sent the case back to the trial court to rehear the motion to set aside the default. 2 years later, it came back to this court, and the court finally put it to bed. And Judge Covington concurring wrote, quote, litigation must end, and parties to litigation must have an ability finally to conclude a matter, however much decisions on the merits of a case are preferred. That same principle applies here. The 2014 judgment's finding of the number of points that Mr. Cullen accrued while he was a reservist during the marriage is final, and the law of Missouri does not allow it to be relitigated 3 years later as a mistake.
But now the respondent is saying that what they're trying to do is actually just enforce that prior final judgment, much like was done in Erickson.
Erickson was a contempt case, and I think that's a really important distinction. If the petitioner, was arguing is that my client had failed to give her some document to which she was entitled, her remedy under the law of Missouri would be contempt. Certainly, the court's contempt power continues long after judgment.
The motion to show cause.
Exactly. A motion for an order to show cause. Mm-hmm. The trial court would weigh whether to grant that order to show cause. Mm-hmm. And then as in Erickson, it would proceed to an evidentiary hearing mm-hmm. to determine whether my client indeed had or had not done what, you know, he was, hadn't done contumaciously what he was ordered to do in the judgment. But that's not what happened here.
So if we grant relief here, then the contempt proceedings are still available.
Theoretically, I mean, if they can prove contempt, I think our position would be they certainly can't prove contempt in some way. But yes, if they can go through that and meet the strictures, the due process that the law of Missouri places on contempt motions, certainly I don't see any reason that they couldn't file that proceeding. At the very least, that would be a proceeding that the law authorizes.
Contempt is to enforce the judgment. This seems like it's trying to change the judgment. Isn't there a difference?
That is a difference. In our reply brief,
what's the latest time that a party in a dissolution case could challenge a judgment based upon the fact that the judgment was based on some fraud that was perpetrated on the court?
It depends on what the fraud was. Rule 7406, which is what I was getting to, mm-hmm. Rule 7406 talks about two different types of fraud. There's Rule 7406B2, which is fraud if you bring it within 1 year, which can be either intrinsic or extrinsic. And then Rule 7406D sets forth an independent action in equity where a party can still allege extrinsic fraud. Now, in this case...
And what's the statute for extrinsic? What's the time limit for extrinsic?
There is no time limit on that.
Okay. In this case, we're dealing with an intrinsic fraud case, correct?
No, Your Honor.
What are the...
Is it intrinsic or extrinsic here?
There's no fraud alleged. It's a mistake.
Okay, this
is the problem. What Ms. Scroggin, so the judgment, the 2014 judgment, expressly found, quote, for the period of the party's marriage, April 30th, 1985 to May 30th, 2009, Mr. Cullen earned 2,134 retirement points. In her 2017 motion to compel, Ms. Scroggin claims she needs discovery, this order to compel my client to disclose these records, to determine whether this finding was true,
right,
because she now believes, quote, this is not the correct number of points.
Assume that even though she didn't plead it that way, that what she thinks is that he gave a false number. At most, that would be an allegation of intrinsic fraud.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And what's the time frame from which they would have to bring a claim?
1 year from the date of judgment. It's 1 year from the date of judgment. The Rule 7406C 1 year statute of limitations applies to allegations of intrinsic fraud, misconduct, misrepresentation, mistake. And there's one other that's in there as well. It doesn't apply to void judgments, for example.
Did the motion to compel mention 7406 at all?
No. And I think that's part of the confusion in this case, Your Honor. I struggled. Why would Judge Harrell do this? I've only ever seen Judge Harrell to be an assiduous and well-thinking judge in judgments of his that I've dealt with on appeal before. And I think what happened here is it's not clear exactly what the motion to compel is. It doesn't cite any authority of any kind, such as a rule or a statute or case law. But to make a really perhaps dumb paraphrasing, if it walks like a 7406B motion and quacks like a 7406B motion, it is a 7406B motion.
Was it a whole new proceeding? Was it a whole new action?
It is a whole new action. That's exactly right. See, so there's a case we cite in our reply brief. It's an Eastern District case from just earlier this year, Universal Credit Acceptance. And what they talk about there is if you have – so after 30 days – under 7501, a trial court's ability to revisit or set aside a judgment stops, right? It has no jurisdiction, no authority, in the language of Webb, to set aside a judgment on its own motion. And it can only do so if there's a properly filed 7406. But 7406, quote, triggers the start of an independent proceeding in which the trial court has a new basis for jurisdiction. There has to be some authority under which the trial court can act. And here, that only possible authority was a 7406B motion for mistake. Because it says that the reason for its existence, the reason she is bringing it, is this finding, express finding, in this previous judgment is, quote, not correct.
Well, even if we were to, or if you would in your argument to indulge, assuming reading what she wrote more broadly to assert fraud because you were hiding, your client was hiding the information, does that make any difference, mistake or fraud, if it's...
No, it's intrinsic fraud. The other side tries to argue that there was some mention or allegation of extrinsic fraud here.
And what's the difference for our purposes?
Sure. The difference is extrinsic fraud has to be some outside thing that happens. Something that's not during the court proceeding, something that there are very few examples out there in the law. There's a Western District case, the name escapes me, from earlier, I think this year, that talks about extrinsic fraud where there was a settlement agreement and one party had kept from the other information necessary to enter into that settlement agreement. But for keeping the information away, they wouldn't have done that. That was held to be extrinsic fraud. I don't know if this court was asked to transfer or not. I forget the case. But here
are the allegations misrepresenting to the court?
Essentially, mm-hmm. Yes. Because there seems to be some confusion, and again, this is partly my fault because I wasn't trial counsel in this mm-hmm. case, but I was told that there had been an evidentiary hearing in the 2014 modification proceedings. Mr. Benj says there was not. He was counsel at the time. He says instead this is a consent judgment. The law doesn't make a difference under the law whether this was a consent judgment or not. The Commonwealth Land Title case makes very clear that consent judgments from the Court of Appeals a couple years ago, we cited in our reply brief, makes very clear that even consent judgments, findings in them, especially when parties agreed to them, are entitled to the full force and effect of res judicata, collateral estoppel, etc. But here, it is very clear that regardless of how this was done, the court says after examining the pleadings and being otherwise well and duly advised, if she is trying to allege, and again, her motion doesn't actually allege this, that my client lied to the court or something like that, unfortunately for her, that would be intrinsic fraud. and that is subject to the one-year time limitation.
But if it's a different proceeding, does 7406 apply?
I don't understand your question,
Your
Honor.
If it's a whole new cause of action, then how does 7406 apply? When
7406 is the new cause of action. So if you file a Rule 7406B motion, even if it's typically as here.
But you said it wasn't mentioned in this new proceeding.
No, it wasn't. But this has to be construed as a 7406B motion.
What's the relief requested? To set aside the prior judgment?
It's for discovery to determine whether there was a mistake.
And what relief can you grant them without setting aside the prior judgment?
That's a very good question.
And that's why it's under 7406.
I think that's exactly why it's under 7406. Some of the 7406 cases that we talk about, including writ cases, there's one in particular. It's the Jackson case from the Western District in 1994. It's Missouri-Nebraska Express versus Jackson, is about prohibiting even taking discovery on a 7406 where it hasn't been properly pled or properly raised. And there's also the Willie case, which I'd submit is directly on point with this case. That's a Willie versus Gum, State Ex Rel Willie versus Gum. It's a Western District case from 1995 where a 7406B was brought for intrinsic fraud or mistake after more than 1 year after the judgment was entered, and the trial court allowed discovery on that, and I think this is similar to some form of allowing discovery, but the Western District said it was more than 1 year after, and as a result, there's no authority for the trial court even to allow discovery on such a thing, and the Western District issued a writ of prohibition prohibiting that. We'd ask the court here to do exactly the same thing, and Willie doesn't go into, the other case too, Jackson, doesn't go into issue and claim preclusion, but even if there could be some way around this 7406C, 1 year statute of limitations, it's still subject to issue and claim preclusion. This amount of points was determined in the 2014 judgment. She's trying to relitigate exactly that. There clearly was an opportunity to litigate that in the prior judgment. We'd ask the court to enter its writ.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Police Court, we all know from just general life experiences and practicing law that if you start out with a fundamentally incorrect proposition, you're probably going to end up with the wrong answer. I do not understand where the relator is getting this concept of a motion to set aside a judgment. The motion was to order the relator to sign an authorization. And as Mr. Sternberg said, to get discovery is how he coined it. But then
why
said,
are you entitled to that? What's your cause of action you're bringing?
We're not bringing
you
any cause.
You can't just file something and say, I want to see somebody's records. You have to have some cause of action.
We have the right under the marital settlement agreement. It says right in the parties agreed that the parties would execute such further documents as are necessary to carry out the terms of the agreement. And the court has the right to enforce not only that agreement, but its judgment, which incorporates the marital settlement.
So why don't you just do a motion to show cause if you're saying in essence that they're in contempt?
But that's more than likely where this would go, either that or a separate cause of action under Rule 74.06D, which...
Or what?
Well, what part of the settlement agreement isn't being complied with right now?
The part that we believe is not being complied with is the very clear part that says that the retired Air Force reservist, will convey one half of the retirement benefit that he earned during the marriage to his wife. So in 2014, he provided a letter saying that he'd earned 2,134 points during the marriage. You then divide that into the total points he earned through his whole career, not only the marriage, but outside of the marriage. We didn't have that number, the denominator, until he became eligible to retire in 2017.
But, go ahead.
So there was no way for us to have any concept that what he'd given us was some false number until we had that denominator, and then we learned that it wasn't 50% of his retirement benefit earned during the marriage, but it was significantly less than that.
Can you assume for a second that you're exactly right at what happened, and in fact the 2,100 number was wrong. It should have been 5,500 or whatever. The problem, from my understanding from your opposing counsel's point of view, is that the judgment set a specific number, and it was the 2130 or whatever it is, and that what you're seeking to do is change that and say it was incorrect. And so while you're not calling it that, you're trying to modify the judgment, to amend it, because you said it was based on a mistake of fact, and it's too late to do that.
We haven't filed any motion to amend the judgment. We haven't sought any relief.
How is it relevant to anything? Then you can't just, again, go in and get discovery without some purpose. You don't just get asked for discovery. It's because you're going to try to modify something or seek a declaratory judgment or do something, and you've just explained what you're going to do is show that the numbers in the original judgment were mistaken. So if you're going to is there something else you're going to show? Because if that's what you're trying to show, you can't do it. But maybe you're trying to show something else that you can.
74.06D allows Ms. Scroggin to file a separate lawsuit to have that judgment set aside if it was because there was fraud on the court.
How long a period of time?
There is no statute, as Mr. Sternberg correctly
for extrinsic fraud?
For extrinsic fraud. Now, that is not even ripe for argument at this point. However, I would call the court's attention to Sanders versus INA, which is a Western District case. And in that case, the defendant tried to make the exact same argument that Mr. Sternberg made, that this false representation of, in that case, it was our policy limit is only 25,000 when it was really a million. And they said, well, that's an intrinsic fraud. And the court said, no. If you make a representation to somebody with the intent that they rely on it to enter into a consent judgment or a settlement or whatever, that's extrinsic fraud. And it acknowledges that the Missouri courts have had trouble defining extrinsic fraud, but that case is about as close as you're ever going to get to this case. If, in fact, there was a false number provided, then we, in fact, are entitled to relief under 7406D. We also are entitled to relief.
But the issue today is, are you entitled to due discovery having not brought a 7406D claim? There is no action pending in which you are entitled to discovery.
We have the right, Your Honor, to enforce the judgment.
That's not what you're trying to do. You've admitted here, you've admitted in your briefs, what you're trying to get is proof that the judgment is wrong. Now, if it's wrong by virtue of fraud on the court, then that's a 7406D motion, but that motion has to get filed, and then you seek discovery under that motion. You can't just walk into court and say, he has an obligation to give us this document under the agreement, which you haven't shown.
He does have the obligation, because the obligation says that he'll provide such documents and execute such documents as are necessary to carry out the terms of the agreement.
And right, and you're not trying to carry out the terms of the agreement. You're trying to change them. That's the problem.
No, the agreement, Your Honor, was that he would provide half of the retirement benefit that he earned during the marriage to his ex-wife.
The numbers are in the judgment.
Pardon me?
I understand that general principle is stated, but the number is in the judgment. If you can't, until you get that judgment set aside, your client, he and his client, all have to abide by the number that's in the judgment, not just the principle. I think that's why you had to go back and get the number in the judgment.
The settlement agreement can be interpreted as a contractual agreement outside of the dissolution judgment.
Correct. And 452.325.4.1 says that the court has an obligation, not just might, but shall enforce the terms of the marital settlement agreement and the judgment. And so this is, I mean, I don't know if I would agree that this is called a discovery request. It's a request that I think is authorized because he's required to execute documents necessary to carry out the terms of the agreement.
How does the statute contemplate that the judgment or the agreement would be enforced?
You mean procedurally, Your
yes.
Honor? It doesn't really address that. It just says that the court shall enforce the terms of the marital settlement agreement and the judgment of dissolution.
In my experience, where you would try to enforce that is in a contempt action. And so if a contempt action was brought and then you sought discovery in the context of that, then maybe this would be appropriate. And I guess what we're all struggling with is your client may be entitled to this information, but there has to be some type of action pending within the court and not just a a request to disclose information?
Well, the allegation, Judge, in the motion to have to require him to sign this order was that he did not comply. He did not comply with the terms of the agreement.
So you're bringing a breach of contract action, then you need to plead it as that, right? And then get discovery to show if he's breached his contract.
It's a motion to enforce his contractual obligation to convey. It would be.
But you're saying he's not complying with it, so that's. But,
and the court made that finding in the order that he hasn't complied with that. Because there was no.
But what if the settlement agreement and the judgment are inconsistent? Because you're saying the settlement agreement says half of what he gets, but the order says you get this amount. You get your percent of this amount, which is different.
No, the original judgment of dissolution that came down back in, I think, 07, when I was not involved, had the incorrect formula. In 2014, we had that corrected by Judge Harrell.
But they put in that number, the 2130 number, that now you're saying was the result of fraud, but it said you base it on these hours, and you're saying the settlement agreement said you base it more generally on what you're entitled to, half of what he earned during the course of the marriage, and that's different than the 2130. So you're trying to enforce the settlement agreement inconsistently with the judgment.
No, the settlement agreement says, that she will get one half of what he earned during
the
marriage.
But that's inconsistent with what the judgment says, according to you.
Well, we believe that now that we have the number from 2017 when he became eligible for retirement, that she did not get one half. It didn't change the fact that she's supposed to get one half. It's just
I'm sorry, I'm probably not being clear. Under the settlement agreement, I understand she's supposed to get one half, and now you have a number, and that number that you have makes you think that the number in the judgment was incorrect. It made an incorrect assumption. But how do we deal with the fact that the judgment says you get a different number, not one half of what you're saying the settlement agreement says you get? So those two documents are inconsistent, if you're correct in your surmise.
If he committed a fraud by taking that Air Force letter and doing something to it and giving it to us, then yes, because of the fraud, we would be getting less than what we were supposed to get and less than what he contractually agreed to get. Yes, that is true. So the question, I guess, becomes, is he going to be allowed?
Are you trying to change the judgment for that reason to match the settlement, or are you saying he's failing to comply with the settlement as a separate contract obligation, which is inconsistent with the judgment?
Well, I think it goes hand in hand. We would say he's not complying with the agreement because he hasn't conveyed one half, and so we're moving to enforce his obligation to convey one half, and the reason that he's not conveying one half maybe because he committed fraud or did something that we're not aware of. That's what we're trying to find out here to see how we're going to proceed with the next step. Is it a motion, is it a separate action under 7604 or 7406D? Is it a motion to have him held in contempt? I don't know, but I think we filed the motion. He had 10 days under our local rule 33.5.1. He let it go. And what they responded with some 28 days later was a motion to dismiss our motion, which is unusual, I guess I would say. And it doesn't address the substantive issues that we asserted in our motion. The judge then dismissed denied their motion to dismiss and granted our motion because there was nothing objecting or denying any of the allegations we made in our motion.
How's this any different than, let's say, for sake of argument, instead of retirement, we're talking about appraisals on real estate, and the husband had two appraisals, and when he made the agreement, he just put in the lower one, but he had a higher one back.
Disclose the higher one?
Yeah, he just didn't disclose the higher one. And everybody agreed to use a lower number. Maybe he had information that made that agreement more favorable to him. At some point in time, I mean, could you file the same sort of motion you're talking about if the marital agreement said generally the parties have decided to divide the marital property 50-50?
I don't believe.
And in this, well, what's the difference?
The difference is that he didn't, in your scenario, Judge, he did not, or she did not, whoever it may be, did not take the appraisal and change it and then provide
it. Maybe he did. Maybe he got it from somebody he paid, and he said, look, could you reduce that $100,000? It's not going to trial, you know, and he gets another one that's $100,000 less, and that's what people make their decision on.
I would say that's a different circumstance than your original scenario, but yes, I think if he did something improper to defraud the court and cause this person, that this person relied on that representation, that this was the appraisal.
Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to figure out at what point does failure to conduct discovery before the judgment affect finality? In other words, there's nothing that she wouldn't have been entitled. The type of request you're making now certainly could have been made prior to the judgment being entered.
Well, so let's take that the next step. So we send over a request for production of documents to the relator, and he sends us the same letter he gave us before, which had the wrong number in it. So I'm not sure that it gets us where we want to get.
Maybe you have an obligation to depose the military or whatever. I'm not saying fraud. I'm not saying mistake, but I can see scenarios in domestic cases where cases would get decided not necessarily on complete information, and how long in the future after a final judgment are we willing to open them up for good reason?
Well, these judgments are always open to enforcement because they've got to. We didn't even know until 2017 what the final number was going to be, but we tried to get information from the government, from the Air Force. We submitted a Freedom of Information Act request, and guess what we got back? We got back, no, this information is covered by a privacy exemption, so we're not going to give it to you. And that's why in the authorization we delineated or put in there that it included information that would be considered private. It wasn't to get in. And by the way, that authorization only requested documents related to his retirement pay. It is a false statement to say that went anywhere beyond that. We're not interested in his medical records, nor did it ask for them. Right. We just simply were trying to get the information that the federal government refused to give us under the Freedom of Information Act. So we did try that.
Mr. Binge?
Yes, ma'am.
The pleading that you filed in the trial court, is it the pleading that you sought to modify the marital settlement agreement?
No, Your Honor. We the modification of the marital settlement agreement motion was filed back in 2014 when we determined that we had.
That was back then. So did you file this in that same case?
Yeah, it's all part of the same dissolution action, Your Honor. There aren't two separate cases.
But that's the problem. See, that case is over. And where is your authority to file anything in that case other than a motion to compel or for contempt? Or for the judge to do anything other than to order a show cause or to enter an order of contempt?
Because the court has specifically it says in the judgment that the court can enforce the provisions of the marital settlement agreement. It adopts them and orders the parties to comply. So if the agreement of the parties is that they will sign documents necessary to carry out the terms of the agreement, and we allege that they did not carry out the terms of the agreement, or the relator didn't, then he has the ability to cause the relator to sign documents as he agreed to do.
I thought you said you filed an independent action. Now you're saying you're filing in the original action.
It's in the original action. If we want, our relief is either to go with a motion for contempt or a separate cause of action, a completely separate lawsuit under 7406D. Mm-hmm. But this is within the original action seeking to cause.
You're seeking to enforce part of the judgment, you're saying?
Correct.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
A few points to clarify some of this, Your Honors. First, let's start with extrinsic versus intrinsic fraud. He cites this case, Sanders versus INA, which does hold that in the context of an insurance settlement, if an insurer lies about the policy limits, that can be extrinsic fraud. I'm not aware of any other cases that say anything like that in Missouri. Instead, we point the court in our opening brief to a case from the Western District in 2015, TB3, which kind of goes over all of this and collects cases. Extrinsic fraud is limited to the fraudulent procurement of a judgment. It must relate to the manner in which the judgment was obtained and not the merits of the judgment itself. What they're trying to relitigate here, or they're alleging that there was fraudulent information to, perjured information was the merits of the judgment. And I think that's the second important point of clarification. Judge Breckeridge, you asked a couple of questions of opposing counsel about the marital settlement agreement versus the 2014 judgment. The 2014 judgment is a product of Mr. Benj, on behalf of Ms. Scroggin, filed what he titled a motion to clarify settlement agreement. And then this judgment is entered, and this is page 40 of our collective exhibits, that says it's granted and that they're changing the formula from the 2009 marital settlement agreement to be this formula. Wife's share of benefits equals one-half times the husband's monthly benefits as and when received times 2,134 points, which is the number of reservist points earned during the marriage, over the number of total reservist points. All right, well, so that numerator, he keeps talking about the denominator. The numerator is what this finds, the number of reservist points he earned during the marriage. It doesn't matter under this formula, which the parties agreed to supersede the 2009 marital settlement agreement's formula. It doesn't matter what the denominator is anymore. I mean, that's what it's going to be. Eventually, that will be discovered. But what her problem is she doesn't like the numerator. Well, the numerator's in the judgment. I mean, it's in the 2014 judgment that changed the marital settlement agreement.
What about this? His argument that he's not trying to change that number or say it's false. All he wants you to do is to sign a document that the settlement agreement incorporated into the judgment requires you to sign, requires your client to sign.
Two responses to that. One, there's nothing that my client has to sign that she can show. I mean, this sweeping, broad order that compels, the military to release all of my client's records, which do include medical records and do say without limitation, that's not anything listed in the marital settlement agreement or the 2014 judgment. And second, the other problem is even if that were the allegation, you can't put discovery before the action. The action would be contempt. If that's their argument, as in the Erickson case, it would have to be a contempt action.
Can they file an action to enforce the settlement agreement? If your client did, in fact, agree to sign documents necessary to give effect to that provision of the dissolution order and settlement agreement, how does one go about giving effect to that if you are required by that to execute documents?
If I may, I see I'm quite out of time. If I may offer two
please
responses
answer a question.
To that.
Thank you.
First, at this point, the formula at issue is the formula that they had entered in the 2014 judgment, not what's in the marital settlement agreement itself. Second, how do you go about enforcing this? I think the Erickson case, which they cite in their own brief, which is pretty similar. I mean, that's where a husband simply wouldn't give, a military retired husband simply wouldn't give any documents at all to the wife so that she could begin collecting her share of the retirement. It would be contempt, because that's what Erickson was. And that's the general way you go about enforcing this. Could it be a separate breach of contract action? I suppose. But again, in all of those, in contempt, in a separate breach of contract action, we have all of the protections afforded by due process and hearings. For example, here this order says my client failed to provide documents. There's been no hearing. There's been nothing to determine this at all. There has to be some due process. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.